Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
Good evening from rainy Los Angeles. My name is Eric 13, and still in Texas, suspiciously still in Texas, is Michael
Kessler. As far as you know, I'm still in Texas.
And I know. This is a FaceTime window.
It looks like Texas behind me.
It looks like your same place. I mean, that's, I don't know. No, I don't know. You could have been doing this from Seattle for the last year. I don't know.
You see a cactus. And like a man on a horse, and so you know I'm in Texas.
Right, it's like a cartoon cutout of Texas.
Yeah.
How the fuck are you doing, Michael?
I was
better
doing...
Better or worse after watching these two films? That's what I'd like to
depends.
Know.
Depends. You know what's funny is I think the order in which I watched them was I broke even.
Okay, that's good.
I feel like had I watched them in the other order, I would be in a nervous place.
All right, well, where do we, how do we want the audience to feel? What order should we do them in accordance to what feeling we'd like to provoke in the listeners?
I honestly think that there's a lot of merit in doing Trouble Every Day first, because there's a certain level of actual exploratory psychology in the second film, A Dangerous Method, which we can then retroactively apply to Trouble Every Day.
I will briefly also make the case that Trouble Every Day really, really wants to stick with you. And it's funnier to me if we do Trouble Every Day second, because then it just lingers with the audience through their life until they force it out with some other film. But in the interest of having a good conversation, maybe we start with it first.
All right.
And then do A Dangerous Method.
I think that's a good move. I think that's a smart move that you had. Smart idea.
All right. We'll reward my smart idea with... a Patreon subscription at patreon.com. I have news, important news.
Mm-hmm. So you give the important news, let me make your good news even better. One of the things that happened since last we spoke to you, Podmanity, is Eric and I stumbled upon a very interesting conversation regarding blockbuster cinema and visionary directors, and it started via text. It's one of those conversations that starts via text and then would have to go to a phone call if either of you had time for that.
Yeah.
But we didn't, so it just ended. And there's no place for us to have that conversation now, unfortunately.
Well, there might be a place called Additional Content.
What?
But there might not be also.
Enter good news, right? I know.
Yeah. That wasn't, I don't actually come bearing that good news. Why'd you have to deflate my good news?
I'm sorry, what was your good news?
You could preempt it because I was going to surprise you.
Oh, shit.
Look, maybe the good news is we can have an additional content. Wouldn't that be nice? And I hope for that. But we're not there yet. First, my good news was just that I figured out it's their patrons.
Oh, they're
That's
called
the
patrons.
Vernacular. That's my
That's
good news.
Thing.
You really, really took the wind out of my sails.
I'm sorry.
Jeez, that whole. All right, well, help rebuild the show here. It's patreon.com/doublefeature. Now that we at least know the correct term to use, maybe we can get an additional content out of this here show. In order to do that, we would like some patrons to sign up on the Patreon. Especially if you're not over there yet. There's a bunch of stuff. We tell you about it all the time. It's still on there. Go look at it. These two films are things that I've been meaning to watch for a long time.
Had you not seen both of these?
Had not seen either. They're both kind of rainy day films, which
cool.
Go well for today.
That's interesting to me. That makes this conversation more interesting to me.
So I think, you know, we're going to obviously spoil these films. We're going to talk about a lot of the themes. We're going to sort of give some backdrop and get into the subject matter and really just pull stuff apart in a way that also might not make a whole lot of sense if you didn't just watch the movies. So there's a bunch of reasons that I would go see those. But also, I mean, come on, guys, you're going to love this fucking double feature. Just go watch these two movies. Trouble Every Day's got a little bit of a French extremey, weird, bloody, smutty thing. And A Dangerous Method is, I don't know, higher brow version of that. I don't know.
Something like that.
Cronenberg-y, dirty, sexy, psychological time, psychoanalytical time. And so there's a little something for everyone, but you don't want to get spoiled. So let's pin this down a little bit more. That was a very lazy summation of the theme here, but mm-hmm. I think you had a better tie, and we talked this one out a little bit. You want to talk about what the theme was for this?
I think that there's a certain level of psychosexuality that's in here, but
that would have been a nice lazy word for me to just throw out and get a lot closer, I guess.
I think what's interesting is that we're doing a movie that would, for all intents and purposes, be a fairly, I mean, I would hesitate to say that Trouble Every Day seems like a David Cronenberg movie, but it definitely seems like a movie that lives in David Cronenberg's universe. And so I think what's interesting about putting that with arguments are to be made that it's the least David Cronenberg movie, which is a dangerous method, I think allows us to use someone we're familiar with who approaches themes in a way that we are well trodden to point at something that would otherwise be terrifying and go, maybe this is something going on here. I feel like David Cronenberg
sort of inroads to that.
Yeah. David Cronenberg kind of allows a conversation for Trouble Every Day other than just panicking. Just putting your hands up and panicking.
For Trouble Every Day or for A Dangerous Method?
It's funny because before I had rewatched A Dangerous Method, I was ready to panic for both.
Yeah, right.
But upon second watch of Dangerous Method, the only thing that I really wanted to go into with Dangerous Method when I started watching it is like, there is no way in hell I'm going to be like, maybe this is the most David Cronenberg movie. Because, you know, that would be the upsetting thing to say, but that's definitely not the fucking case.
Yeah, what a twisted place you're in where the David Cronenberg element of a movie is the part that reassures you and calms you about its subject matter.
Right.
Only here would people go, oh, I don't know about psychoanalysis. Oh, wait, David Cronenberg psychoanalysis? Okay, maybe I understand this. So we'll get to that second, but you hit on something interesting with this first movie already. And I think this was, you know, we knew this thematically a little bit, but I didn't know how much Trouble Every Day would play into the backdrop and some of the plot elements of early Cronenberg movies.
Mm-hmm.
And not even the really obvious stuff, but the things that when you're watching the marathon, Twisted Science and the Medical Fringe and those early beats for Scanners and the Brood and all of that stuff back then, that became sort of the excuse to get together and do body horror and do, you know, explosive gory scenes. I think the thing that's lost on a lot of conversation about Cronenberg is people don't immediately go, yeah, Fringe Science, which really was it was the plot of so many of those.
Mm-hmm.
And a movie like The Brood or like Crash, you know, there's definitely Crash elements in Trouble Every Day. I think The Brood's a really good go-to because The Brood's also, you know, it's a woman with so much power that she must be repressed or contained at home in some way that there's just this harnessed chaos that if it were to get out into the world would cause massive destruction. It's a weird look at femininity and then sexuality. In Cronenberg movies, it's also becomes about motherhood and, I don't know, boils or whatever gross stuff is happening in those movies. But this is done in a way that, you know, it's like you're writing a Cronenberg movie and then when you start directing it, it becomes a whole different beast.
One of the things that this movie has taught me is that it's taught me something about performances in a film. And that's because of Vincent Gallo. I'm not sure if he's the worst at acting or the best, because there's just something about his character in this and something about where his character lives in the world of Trouble Every Day where I just know he's fucking weird. There's just something weird about him
you're suspicious of him when you
super. Yeah. I mean, even the, in the opening beats where his entire performance is just him being a very doting and loving
you
boyfriend.
Don't believe it, right? It just seems fucking ridiculous.
I go, yeah, okay, but there's something weird. And it's funny because the trajectory of the film like kind of paints that. It's like, oh, there's like this cute couple and they're like very much in love. And they go on the other side. There's this weird situation where this woman fucks people to death. And I go, yeah, no, but I'll tell you what's really weird is this Vincent Gallo guy.
right.
I'm not so sure about fucks. You know, when the inside lady fucks people to death, that's fine. I'm behind that.
I bet that's built in. I really think that, you know, he'd done Buffalo by then. You have to understand where these movies are made. French movies especially are so made for fans of cinema. There's such an inside, sorry, not to double play on you bringing up inside, but they are such a cinema made for fans of cinema. They're made for people who know who Vincent Gallo is and who saw his other movies. So not to say they only work for those people. I think they work for everybody, but this is a inside the art house kind of collective audience. I think when you make a movie like this, I mean, I don't want to speak for the director, but if I had to take a guess, it seems like you would make this movie thinking about certain people in the critic world, certain people in the art world, and what they might think about it, or how conversations, you know, at Cannes will go, or these other different festival places. And so when you cast Vincent Gallo, I think you do it because people come to the movie with, it's as if you already got 2 hours where you were watching him in one of his movies and learning about that character. So when he shows up in frame one of this, he sort of brings a kind of baggage with him that I feel like the movie means to tap into. I would guess the movie means
to tap into. That's what I'm wondering, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, we don't know, right? But it certainly did for me.
Do you, when you're watching this film, and I don't necessarily care to have you spell it out, but do you feel like there's a clear through line to this plot?
Well, I think, you know, I look at the genre first.
Right.
Which is so quintessentially for you and me, because it's like erotic thriller meets French extreme movie.
Yeah.
Right. It's just like made for us. And then it's also got maybe a supernatural element that maybe we can get to, or who the fuck cares? I could go either way on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, when I think about, you introduced me to the French extreme movies. And when I think about French extreme movies, the gore is one piece, and a piece that interests me a lot, and I feel like I'm always talking about the different ends to which gore is used. But there's also a very broad existential place that the movies play. It's a fancy way of saying the movies are vague. They're always very vague. A movie like Martyrs just goes, I don't know, religion and the mind of God or something, and then off to the races. And I think that's what I was saying when we started about the way that the movie tries to stick with people. I think it leaves a small taste in the audience's mouth and then tries to just stay with them over time. So if it were to spell out too much plot-wise, if it were to give you that through line, then I think you ponder about it a lot less.
Right.
I think it's probably there. But the movie definitely knows it's being pretty vague in not spelling things out too much. And I don't even know if that's something that makes more sense when you rewatch it as much as it is, you know, these are all conversation piece movies and sometimes endurance test. It's like, this is my other fucking favorite thing about French extreme movies is they go, hey, we're going to be really hard to watch and we're going to require repeat viewings to fucking understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think this is, I don't want to say it's tame because it seems detrimental to things in that genre, but it should be applauded to even say it approaches that genre.
Sure.
Because it's also mixing in a lot of other pieces of melodrama. So it's not exclusively in it to be vague and shock and then run off.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as far as a through line goes, you'd have to take some guesses. And it's really meant to be, you know, for two people to sit on, let's say, a podcast and bounce those off each other, maybe. You know, like, all right, so he comes over to Paris on a honeymoon, but not really. And then he starts looking for some scientists. And I don't think we ever really get much more information than that.
Right.
Except that there's some weird case of a woman that has something going wrong with her. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We're told she's sick, whatever that means. And then, you know, if you're in the room with her, then some bad times happen. And when he leaves the room, he goes and causes his own bad times.
Mm-hmm.
Are there more details I'm missing? I feel like it, that those are the pieces it gives us to move around and figure out what the fuck we're doing.
No, I mean, that's kind of why I asked, is more or less to find out whether it mattered.
Yeah.
Because I think when you're, you know, I watched this movie on a plane.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of just me in this movie. And what was interesting, I felt, about watching it in a public setting is I kept having to like turn my screen away from people.
I love it.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was
the
like
utter shame that the movie
and that gave it that really like gave it an element that I don't get a lot of when I watch movies, because you know, like you and I, we watch, you know, fucking Trouble Every Day or Puppet Master, The Littlest Reich, or you know, whatever. But we're watching it from at worst a room full of people who have signed up to watch it.
Yeah.
And other than that, in the comfort of our own home and privacy. So it's I don't know if I've ever considered the idea of watching a movie in public that other people haven't signed up to watch.
Yeah.
And you kind of have
almost like a moral dilemma there, right?
Well, yeah. And what I gathered, you play these thought
experiments. What you gathered by the people who requested to move seats there.
Well, but what's, you know, I'm sitting there going like, so what? Somebody stops me and goes, excuse me, what are you watching? What's going on in this scene? And I find myself going, I don't really know.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And it's just, this movie, I feel like is probably the worst movie to have that experiment with. But it's vivid in a lot of ways where, and maybe this isn't conducive to a podcast to say this, but a lot of the movie seems inexplicable verbally. But when you watch it, you definitely have a strong idea of where things are and what's going on.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very visual movie in that the story is, I shouldn't say the story, but the content of the film is not necessarily narrative in the sense that. So let me put this another way and make it way easier instead of trying to figure out the right way to say this. I feel like you could get as much out of this movie if you never turned subtitles on.
Yeah, I was going to say that too. Well, it's sparse.
Yeah.
And I think that's when you're talking about something that is, what was the simple shorthand I used? Vague. When you're talking about a movie that's vague, let's stick with that.
Mm-hmm.
Tired of talking about existentialism on this show. When you're talking about a vague movie that wants you to fill in some of that yourself and wants to let you chew on it and think about it, I think the locations do a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
This movie spends so much time wandering these cold, empty locations. And that puts you in a place, it almost feels like 28 Days Later to me.
Yeah.
You know, where you're just, it's almost like a post-apocalyptic, it's sparse. There's just no one around. And what that means is you're free of any responsibilities. You don't have to go to work. You don't even really have any friends in this world. You just explore alone. And you can explore anywhere you want, but you might wander into a house where you get fucked to death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it seems like this place you can just float through and be curious, but there are still dangers.
Right.
Smutty dangers.
Smutty dangers, the worst kind.
Used to artistic ends, which is the other great part of, you know, both the best French extreme movies and the best erotic thrillers is that it almost seems like the audience has to question the merits of the nudity and the sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the merits were clear, there would be no excuse to provoke conversation and thought. You sort of, I mean, it's like you're describing on the plane, half of somebody going, what are you looking at? I mean, I understand what you're getting at, but don't you also think a big piece of that is just someone sees you watching a bunch of people banging and feels like you have to explain yourself?
Sure. Well, I mean, that's the thing is the movie really presents itself as a parade of ideological images. And I don't, mm-hmm. I guess ideological isn't the right word because it's not, it's a parade of thought-provoking images.
But they seem to demand that the viewer explain them instead of the
right.
film. The
no,
film
that's
is,
what I mean.
Is aggressive
yeah.
in a way that puts the viewer on defense
mm-hmm.
and makes them, it's a defensive position
right.
to kind of think, okay, well, I want to accuse this movie of just being dirty, but at the same time, I don't understand what it's doing. So you look at the erotic elements and kind of go, okay, well, maybe this is used to this end.
Mm-hmm.
And it slow rolls your own criticism. You know, I mean, you and I never care if movies are being smutty, but mm-mm. I think a lot of audiences have a knee-jerk reaction of, is this, what's the word people use? It's not superfluous. That's the...
Gratuitous?
Gratuitous. Thank you.
Yeah.
If something is being gratuitous or if it quote unquote has a point to it.
Right.
And I think by playing on that razor's edge, the movie does yet another thing where it's, you know, it's pushing buttons a little bit to make you think about it and sort of justify it in your own way.
Well, and I think that the first thing that the movie does, to go back to the very beginning of this conversation, Eric, is it betrays the audience by making the only person that you can possibly hang on to fucking Vincent Gallo.
I know.
Yeah. And you're like, I just don't, this guy, I know you're telling me he's in my corner, but I'd rather be in a different corner than this guy. It's not unreliable. I'd prefer not to narrator.
Right. Sure. Well, yeah. When I just told you could spend all this time wandering and exploring locations, it's like, oh, that's kind of exciting. And your tour guide is Vincent Gallo.
Yeah.
Well, hold on a second.
Yeah.
Can I pick literally any other tour guide? Is that how I have to? Yeah. But he's going to get you into the best trouble, which is, mm-hmm. you know, which is good for this film. But we spend this time lingering in not just his private moments, but also, you know, like the maid's private moments in all the characters and sort of seeing what they do in these places, both when people aren't looking and then when any two random characters in the movie decide to bang each other,
mm-hmm.
then we get to see what happens there too. But there's these, it reminds me, you and I were talking about that movie Naked, talking about pairing that with something on the show, Mike Lee movie, I think. Reminds mm-hmm. me of that a lot. You know, it's a lot of secret stolen moments of human behavior. You know, the maid washing her feet and getting dressed and kind of hanging out in those places that just randomly also, as an added bonus almost, become gory encounters at mm-hmm. a moment's notice. Just cutting away from psychosexual drama into, you know, painting in blood on the walls or whatever. And I think it's weird because as we talk about this movie, I drift back and forth on whether I'd really even want to call it a French extreme film.
Mm-hmm.
But those moments of violence are done in a way that is so quintessentially fucking French extreme, where the encounters don't cap on the agony. You know, when we mm-hmm. were just talking Puppet Master as a brutal film and one that's really, you know, ridiculously violent and overkill. When you look at the deaths in that film, or you compare it, we were talking about it against Halloween. That's a great example to watch those two back to back and see that. But a lot of horror movies make an art out of doing a vicious death and knowing just the moment to cut away when you've made your point, but not worn out your welcome. And another thing that I've always just loved so dearly about French extreme movies and why I think of this as one is in the gore, a normal movie would cut away once it's made its point. And I don't think, I don't think that's untrue of French Extreme, but I think if it were to cut away when the agony starts to set in, it wouldn't have, you know, that's the point where a French Extreme movie just starts to accomplish its goal.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about the brutality itself, but really what the characters who are having this terrible thing happen to them feel. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about this as a French Extreme movie in the same case that I think you could make for Irreversible being a French Extreme movie, even though it's not as bloody or as horror-y, but it really drags you through the moments of human suffering to say, you can't study and understand suffering if you're not sitting with it, mm-hmm. if you're not experiencing it alongside the characters in a way that almost criticizes other films. Almost says, you know, other films cop out. They go, yeah, you understand this moment. What you're supposed to get here is that a person's suffering, but that's miserable. So let's cut away and go do something else now. And a French Extreme movie goes, oh, good. Well, we finally got to the part we're here for, the suffering. You know, he goes down on the girl and then it's just her crying and screaming out as he's just fucking devouring her. I mean, that's how all the encounters play out in this movie. That's when it feels like the movie's doing the thing that it kind of showed up to do.
Mm-hmm.
We can have some conversation some other time about the merits of that or to what ends that's done. But that is so fucking French Extreme. And that is, you know, that's what I would rest my case on for this as a French Extreme movie itself, at least in part, mm-hmm. in those pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's vampires. I guess we'll never know.
So going into A Dangerous Method, there's kind of two things that I want to spin off on. And the first thing is to talk about A Dangerous Method in the context of David Cronenberg's filmography. And this is, it's just important to look at this movie where it lands and in his chronology, because I think it's very clear the spin from the film before and the film after. So this is between Eastern Promises and Cosmopolis, which is the point that David Cronenberg went from incredibly compelling movies starring Viggo Mortensen in award-worthy roles into films written at a college reading level. And what you have here is both at the same time.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd spend a moment on this because this is really an area that our show is built to tackle, just because we've done the legwork now of studying really everything after this and much of what came before it to figure out, all right, well, where does it sit for Cronenberg?
So the first time I watched A Dangerous Method, I watched it as a big fan of The Fly and Naked Lunch and Videodrome and Eastern Promises even. And I went, what is this? I'm disappointed. I mean, that's how I felt. I saw it at the Century in Chicago. Remember the Century?
Oh, wow.
The only place to see art films in Chicago because the Music Box at the time only showed like old movies. And I just remember seeing it, and you know, you do that thing that I know you do, even if you won't admit it, where you go, it's a director I like, so I have to say I liked the movie, but if I'm being honest with myself, I was very disappointed.
I do that about a lot of subgenres these days.
Yeah.
Where I just go, oh, I guess this is the type of thing I like.
Yeah.
Is this movie on brand for me? I guess I'll tell people I liked it.
Yeah. So then I went, and you know, you get further down David Cronenberg's filmography. He does Cosmopolis and he does Maps to the Stars. And then I go back and revisit A Dangerous Method on the heels of watching Trouble Every Day. And suddenly I go, this movie is incredible.
Yeah.
And I was too dumb the first time I watched it. And I think that what I really like about this double feature, and I don't know if you feel this way, but what I really like about this double feature is that Trouble Every Day gives me all the visceral things that David Cronenberg usually hands me. And then Dangerous Method is just David Cronenberg basically beating me over the head with college level themes to be able to digest the movie I just watched. And I think that what basically I really like about it in the context of this double feature is that it opens up the thought experiment of, I know that's fucked up, but maybe you should do it anyway. Because that's kind of the basic premise of this film. And also, I'm glad that you ended the last conversation with vampires, because this movie is also, should we talk about vampires at all? I don't think we should. And there's one guy going, I think we should talk about vampires. And the other guy's going, yeah, but you're fucking your patient, so who the fuck are you to decide?
Right. So funny. It's a movie about a friendship torn apart by witchy bullshit.
Yeah.
Every movie on double feature is now a conversation about that. Mm-hmm. So before we move off of the Cronenberg, because I think it's interesting to me a lot.
Yeah.
Where else do you see this? I mean, I guess the thing that I'm really trying to get at is what, now that you've looked at it in that specific way and we've seen this other stuff, what makes it like a Cronenberg movie and what makes it unlike one?
I mean, I think the best way to look at this in David Cronenberg's canon is it's almost like he figured out a way to have a conversation about his previous 20 years of filmmaking by putting it in a period drama and framing it in a real place, because this is a conversation between experts in their field about whether or not neurosis is based in sexuality, which, hello, it's David Cronenberg. If neurosis based in sexuality is a theme in anything, it's pick a David Cronenberg movie.
Right.
Pick the one with the twins with the vagina tools.
Yeah,
pick
the one. Say, let's ask these twin gynecologists.
Yeah, right.
Like, see what they think.
So the fact that he basically creates a film where he goes, experts agree with my themes.
Yeah, right.
And then also uses the element of Jung versus Freud, where David Cronenberg's going, is this magic or is it science? David Cronenberg. You know, you said, you called out earlier the fringe science, and I think, you know, that's what this is. This is a movie literally talking about which side of the fringe are we on.
Yeah, sure.
It's two guys going, you're going too fringy, and the other person's going, you're not going fringy enough.
Yeah.
And then I think that the big difference is that nobody like mutates.
Yeah,
there's
but there
zero
is
mutation.
There is this duality that's considered. Usually that's within one person or within one idea. But here the duality is the very split in something that should be the same field, the same vocation, the same fucking patient. But there is a difference of opinion that causes that split.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's totally possible I'm fucking reading into it, but it's also the central conflict of the movie is these two men, how they're torn apart and how this other character is maybe not the catalyst for that, but certainly how she plays into it and illuminates these pieces of their conflict that they're too stubborn really, or just don't, or aren't ready to address, or just don't want to. They keep trying to walk away from the negotiating table, and she keeps dragging them back together through both an honest method, but also
a dangerous one.
I was really trying not to do that.
Sorry.
Well, through manipulation as well.
Right.
She has such a great arc,
especially,
I mean, just go back and watch the first 10 minutes of the movie. When the movie's over, you won't believe it's the same fucking character.
Well, that's the thing. Like, if you look at this movie and you want to, like, one of the many ways to get somebody to watch this movie with you is to go, you want to see Keira Knightley get the crazy fucked out of her?
Right. I mean, yeah, it is maddening for sure.
But it's insane because it's very David Cronenberg, because just like anything, there is insanity going on the screen that if I went, do you think a psychologist should fuck his patient if it definitely means that that patient will be cured? You and I would both go, no. The answer is no, hands down. And David Cronenberg goes, what if it's an expert? What if it's consensual? What if, you know, it works? What if there's evidence that it may work out? What if it's predicated on all? And you go, okay, listen, I said no before, but you have given me so much evidence to the contrary that I am willing to entertain the opinion, at which point enter Sigmund Freud and I go, fuck.
Well, Well, the entire subject matter of the movie is, you know, it's a lot more daring a movie than I thought it would be. It reads like a bunch of conversations you can't even start having in polite society. Mm-mm. And it just dives deep into them. And then, you know, creates this opposition once you're in the weeds in the conversation. I would feel like I have left something out if I didn't also, while we're getting obnoxiously into this weird split dichotomy, also point out the weird split diopter, which the thing we usually talk about is split focus.
Yeah.
Like somebody, that DP showed up that day and went, oh, I get what you're doing here. Mm-hmm. Check this out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, split diopter is the thing that it's basically like a filter that caps on a lens. There's a lot of ways to do it. And it just allows you to have a different focal point. And it's always used in this movie to look at two different characters at once. I mean, that's often what you use it for, but fuck if that doesn't play right into the goddamn theme we're sitting here going, oh, I don't know, is it about this duality? Mm-hmm. And it's like, here, let me just put this fucking thing on the lens. So yeah, we have Viggo, which is very Cronenberg as Freud
at the time. Yeah.
And then like Fassbender and Cassell seem like they should just be Cronenberg staples forever.
Cassell was in Eastern Promises at least.
Yeah. But fucking all I want to talk about is Keira Knightley's performance. I've never found myself in a position where I'm like, I need to talk about Keira Knightley for a long time. Mm-hmm. Let me bust out this chart. And but her, God, her performance is just, I don't even know the word to use. It's like the place that it begins. Okay, so it's the arc that's the most impressive to me. But even if it wasn't the arc and it was just the fucking crazy of the beginning of the movie, it is exasperating. It makes me physically tired to watch. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the last time just a performance alone. I mean, movies do this to me all the time. And that's kind of the language that I think about. A movie that could make me feel this way or make me feel that way. We're always talking about that. Mm-hmm. But this, I literally just mean the performance. Her character, if her character was not in the movie, I would not feel this way.
Right.
And if that character walked in any other fucking movie, I'd go, oh God, this lady again. She's like, hold on, I need to have lunch before we do this. I can't keep up. But she doesn't operate at anything slower than a 10 at all times. The scene when they're on that boat, I mean, they're just trying to take a chill boat ride. This woman has no fucking chill. She cannot relax. And, you know, she's almost the unsung character in it because she's helping these two characters that are stand-ins for their own theoretical ideas, right? And psychoanalytical ideas. But if this were a movie that was just a character study, she's the most interesting person as somebody who can somehow go from like cannot operate in polite society to somebody operating in the very fields that was necessary to, you know, to fix whatever the fuck is going on with her. I like how you think the fixing is just fucking. If everybody was just getting laid more, you'd just fuck the crazy out of everybody.
That's one of the most interesting dynamics, and I think one of the most Cronenbergian themes to this movie is, and it's a question that they entertain and I feel like they discuss at length and then never really get an answer to because you don't have one. Mm-hmm. But it basically, the question between the two scientists in this movie boils down to the idea of, is sexual repression the reason society is fucked up?
Yeah.
And I think that is, her character is meant for us to see what that might look like. You know, what a person who's not sexually repressed, what that can change in a person, you know what I mean? To give you a firsthand, because that's a difficult thought experiment to play. What somebody, you know, this movie, if we really wanted to do a disservice and really hammer this specific point home, we would pair this with Chasing Amy. and
yeah,
and just make it like a is everyone's
we
problem.
Might, we might owe Chasing Amy that.
That's
after
true.
All the smack we've talked about
it's,
it.
It's do do is everyone's problem that they need to get laid. You know,
that's. Yeah. I mean, I think there's room for more movies to drive that point home. I think maybe all movies should fucking drive that point home.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that is, of all the themes we've ever talked about in movies, that's one of the things about film, and you'll hear it in so many of the movies we talk about, that bugs me the most about just where we are in society. And, you know, maybe that says more about me and the things that I get older. As I get older, I get like comfortable or uncomfortable talking about or watching on planes or whatever. But I, you know, 10 years ago, I didn't feel the kind of sexual repression just in reading a room that I do now.
Mm-hmm.
Now I feel like so much more is off the table. Sex is so much more of a taboo, and that making sex such a taboo, especially today, as finally all these Me Too stories are getting called out, it means the only time we're talking about sex in a public way is to talk about all these fucking terrible things that have happened. So, you know, I think those two things are unrelated, but I think that's yet another reason why it's terrible that we've gotten back to this strange puritanical place where people just don't publicly talk about sex. Our movies don't show sex. Our movies shy away from nudity. Audiences demand a reason for there to be sex or
right.
naked parts in anything.
Right.
I will say, though, of those two things that I don't think have... I think sex was a taboo long before Me Too.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the fact that, you know, the fact we're not talking about sex as society doesn't mean we shouldn't be talking about Me Too because it gives sex a bad name. It just means it's as important as ever to stop leaving sex in the dark and mm-hmm. not talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we need to be talking about that more. And, you know, a movie like this that does it in such a, I don't know, such a courageous way. I mean, it's just it's the entire movie.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's unapologetically articulate, and it makes it hard for you to feel like it's not operating at a classy level. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that right. makes the conversation highbrow, even though it's actually in the dirt.
Well, it's beyond even invoking the sex. It's having the kind of conversations you could have if sex wasn't such a taboo.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
You know, it's the whole notion that these guys have to repair their friendship to save psychoanalysis, which, by the way, is a crazy idea. Imagine if a whole field relied on you talking to some dude, and if you stop talking to him, the field would fall apart.
Like podcasts and you and I.
Well, I couldn't even find, I mean, that's the obvious joke for me to try and formulate here, but I couldn't even find anything that seemed considerably, it's such a crazy notion that I feel like that is the taboo of this movie. The mere thought that a whole field could possibly rest on these two people, but it does use that to, again, like I said before, to get in the fucking weeds on this, which is just the coolest thing for it to do. And what that means is we always have this capsule of this conversation, that anytime it feels like sex is too much of a taboo, that this movie not only tears that down, but it tears it down by example. It goes, oh, you want to see a time where it wasn't a fucking taboo? That time is the hour 45-minute runtime or whatever of this movie play.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've just transported yourself into a society that's not only okay talking about it, but Keira Knightley has shown up and is doing all the work. It's amazing. I'm as happy this exists as I've ever been happy anything exists, including Double Feature. Website is patreon.com/doublefeature. Go on there. If you're happy about all the people banging on the show, you can, I don't know, put in a couple dollars. Where am I going with this? This seems kind of dangerous. Maybe I... No, fuck it. You can put in a couple dollars and people will keep banging. List of people who are banging, of course, is what I was getting to. Abbott of Unreason, Ben Ecker, Brett Hayton, Charles Crawford, John Mark Abbott, Tom Leonard, and Bruno, who has joined the list.
Oh, shit.
Of executive producers.
Oh, shit.
Thanks, man.
Thanks
to all you guys.
Yeah.
And thanks to everybody who put in even $2 on the Patreon. Let's just keep doing movies. We got a couple more movies next time.
Yep. The producer's orgy has allowed us to come up with another set of films next week. And it's not less weird, guys, unfortunately, for those of you.
Is there
going
to be less vagina, though? Because I feel like after Trouble Every Day and French cinema in general, I'm not sure you could pack more vaginas in a film.
It's definitely not the quintessential vagina.
All right. I don't know what that means. Michael has declared the French vagina is the quintessential vagina. All other vaginas be damned. Oh, look, in real time, I see all our Patreons disappearing. patrons.
We're going to do an Indian film that is available on some streaming services called Tumbad, T-U-M-B-B-A-D. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to pair that with another film called Baskin. And this pair is about, it's about, you know, contemporary man dealing with the old gods, intentionally, unintentionally, allegorically, not allegorically, violently, certainly. So, you know, bake your dough, boys, and come see us next week. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.